Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Raven Cast. My name is Adam Erickson, and the Raven Cast is a product of the Raven Review, an online magazine where we talk about mimetic theory and the violence and rivalry and conflict that so often seems to divide our neighborhoods, our families, and our nation and our world. So there's a fair bit of that going around these days, I think. So worth talking about here today. You can check out all the writings and the videos over at ravenfoundation.org on the Raven Review. And today I am here with my colleague at Raven, the co-founder of the Raven Foundation, Suzanne Ross. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, Adam. Good to be with you today.
Well, it's great to have you here. We have a lot to talk about today because there have been some current events that have been happening that that we should talk about.
Yeah. I mean, there are two issues in particular that are hot topics in the news right now that both bear on how Christian religion is practiced in the public sphere. One that's been hot, you know, unfortunately for weeks and months and years is how we treat immigrants. And there's been recent changes in policy coming out of the Trump administration about how we treat immigrants showing up at our southern border with Mexico. And then the other issue was just this week on Monday, the Supreme Court ruled on a case called, I love the names of these cases, Masterpiece Cake Shop versus the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. And that involved this case, which many people are aware of this Christian bakery saying that they, on religious grounds, have had the right to refuse to bake a wedding cake for a gay couple. The Civil Rights Commission in Colorado said, no, you don't. You don't have a right to refuse service. But the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the baker and against the Civil Rights Commission. Now, and the reason why I found really interesting was that the Civil Rights Commission, according to the Supreme Court, used language that appeared to be hostile to religion. And so, you know, being medic theoreticians, we were very intrigued by both the words hostility and religion. And when you put them together, it piques our interest. And it was as if, as I'm reading that the Supreme Court was lumping hostility to religion as being just as bad as being hostile to this gay couple, that you know, you can't, gay people need the right to be protected, but so does religion. And I thought, let me talk with Adam about that, because mimetic theory states that there's a long biblical tradition of hostility to religion. And you recently wrote about that in a sermon. So I wanted to ask you to respond to that idea of what is religion and what does this mean to be hostile to religion?
Yeah, well, there's one theory that religion, the term religion, comes from a Latin word, ligare. Think of it like ligaments that bind you together. So religion is this, as a social thing, is something that binds us together. And Girard, mimetic theory, puts forward this idea that religion is there often and binds us together in a way that is over and against a common enemy, or what Girard calls a scapegoat. So I was talking with our friend Sandor Goodhart once and just said, this is like just finding a common enemy. And he says, that's it. That's it. That's the essence of mimetic theory. Religion is often based on sacrificing an other that we unite over and against. And the sacrifice can be, you know, like an ancient archaic form of sacrifice where you, you know, get a knife and do the bloody sacrifice thing. Or it can be simply gossiping about someone or making sure that they don't enter into our domain, our sacred space. Right. So this is what archaic religion does. This is what René Girard calls archaic religion. It's us against them. And mm-hmm. what Girard says is that the Judeo-Christian movement is exactly that. It's a protest against the archaic sacred. So you could say very easily that the Judeo-Christian movement is a hostile movement towards religion that separates us against them. Right? In the beginning, God created humanity in the image of God. There's no us and them there. We're all in on this. And you see this in the ancient, in the books of the Bible. So in Egypt, in the Exodus, who's created in the image of God? It's the Pharaoh. The Pharaoh is the one who is created in the image of God. So what the Hebrew people are doing are protesting. They're hostile towards any religion, ancient Egypt or modern American religion, that separates us against them, that says, here is the voice of God. Here is the image of God in the powerful, in the elite. And they say, no, the image of God is in the immigrant, is in the refugee, is right. in those who are on the margins. You want to look for a place in the New Testament for this. There are plenty of them. Most specifically, the letter of James. James says in chapter 1, verse 27, religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this, to care for orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself unstained from the world. And whenever the New Testament talks about the world, it's not like, oh, like the natural, the physical world, the trees and all of that. It's not that all of that is evil. It's the way the world is in the New Testament is the way that we structure the world, the way that we structure, the way that we live towards with one another in this archaic way of us against them.
Yeah.
So what is true religion? It's where you care for those who are labeled them. That's it.
Yeah.
That's the religion that's holy towards God.
Yeah. I think what you're pointing to really clearly, Adam, is that a lot of times we think about religion as like a particular religion, like a Christian or Jewish or Muslim, or we think about it in terms of what do you believe? And so all these different religions believe different things, and we tend to argue with each other about what we believe. But the way that you're talking about it, I mean, what the biblical tradition is talking about is how is a set of practices about how do you act in the public sphere? And we're very much concerned about how you're acting, right? About mm-hmm. how you're behaving. And so there's a distinction that's being made between, and you point out this, point to this in your sermon in the Exodus narrative, is making this huge distinction between the way of being that's the Egyptian way and the way that God is calling the Israelites to be. You say that God isn't just leading the Israelites to the promised land. He's telling them and warning them, don't go back to Egypt. Don't go back to the ways of Egypt, because there's always that risk that even after having heard God's call, you fall back into this old practice, right?
Yeah. And that's the thing that is so important about the Bible and so important, especially about the prophetic tradition, is that the Bible is honest that we brought Egypt with us.
Mm.
You know, it doesn't mm-hmm. cover over the fact that, yeah, we have these laws and specifically the Sabbath law, right? And the Sabbath law is kind of the, you might say the anti-Egypt law, the anti, Israel continues to have slaves in the ancient world, but every seventh day, you give everybody a rest, right? Your slaves, your servants, whatever you want to call them, your men and women, even your ox gets a day of rest. You never had rest in Egypt. You were never treated as a human being in Egypt that needed mm-hmm. rest. Mm-hmm. And so this is the movement. And every 7 years, there's a law in Deuteronomy, every 7 years, you let the slaves free. So this is where you get this sense that God is on the side of freedom, not slavery, because right. this is all going to end in their freedom in 7 years. Mm-hmm. So this is like we moderns today can say, oh, how, and I guess rightly we should, how awful the form of slavery is. Yes, it's awful. It's awful. And it's in the Hebrew scripture, but there's also the laws that, you know what? God doesn't want this. God wants freedom. So set them free.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you point to this, the way Jesus interpreted the law, that Jesus didn't sort of throw out the law, but he was saying, now you got to be careful how you're using the law, right? Because you can use it the way the Egyptians use it. Law, right. meaning your religion, your the structure of your religion.
Yep.
Can be used in a way that goes against God's intention, right?
Yep. Yeah. So the intention of the Sabbath law was to give people healing, uh-huh. was to give people rest, was to set people free from oppression. And so Jesus has this conflict with the Pharisees. He's about to heal on the Sabbath. And he says, the Pharisees come to him to test him to see if he'll heal on the Sabbath. And he heals this man who has a withered hand. He says, just stretch out your hand, just do it. And he does, and he's healed. And this is where the Pharisees turn against him because he's broken the law. Right. And I want to be very careful here. This isn't Judaism bad, Christianity good, right? Mm-hmm. That's how this often gets put forth. These are certain groups of Pharisees in the first century who are trying to trap Jesus. Other Pharisees in the first century were on Jesus' side. We see this in Nicodemus and other Pharisees. So it's important to make that point. But these certain Pharisees are after Jesus, and when he heals on the Sabbath, this is where they start to plan to kill him.
Yeah.
Right. And Jesus says that the Sabbath, how does he phrase it? The Sabbath was not made for humans. Humans were made for the Sabbath, or something like that. It's a way to relativize not just the Sabbath law, but all of the law. All of the law was made for the flourishing of the world, of mm-hmm. human beings. And when you start using the law in a way that creates us against them, you are going against mm-hmm. the will, the love, the desire of God.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Jesus shows. And that's what James picks up in his statement that we said earlier.
Yeah. I mean, when you think, though, about the Pharisees, we do tend to, you know, demonize the Pharisees who were always criticizing Jesus. And it's easy to do that, I suppose. But it comes out of this genuine, I think, feeling of really wanting to follow the law and wanting to be faithful and true to the law. And I see that in the Christians who don't want to bake for, you know, gay weddings, who don't want to do the flowers or whatever. They're working very hard to follow the law and be righteous in following the law. But what would you say to them, Adam, about the way in which they're using the law here?
It's tricky. Part of me wants to say you're misinterpreting the law, you know, mm-hmm. but that's a shaking of a finger at them. And when you start doing that, nobody's going to listen. Nobody's going to, you know, mm-hmm. nobody is going to change their mind because you tell them that they're doing their religion wrong. But, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, no, it's difficult. It's very,
so
difficult.
I think one of the things that I constantly have to ask myself is, what is the goal? Is the goal, transformation? Is the goal, mm-hmm. you know, what's is the goal just me getting my anger out? If that's it, then fine. But that's not going to lead to transformation.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the goal? And I think part of the goal is first to build up trust with people. Mm-hmm. You know, like if I'm in the area where I can build up trust with people that I think differently about religion and build a relationship mm-hmm. with them. And I think that they are using religion and law in a way that divides us against them. I think the first thing that you have to do before you start criticizing them is try to get on their side. Mm-hmm. Try in some way, in some area of life, try to befriend them. This, I think, is what Jesus is getting at when he says, love your enemies as you love mm-hmm. yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, framing it as enemies is already kind of a hostile way to frame it. But I think what the point is how do you befriend those that you call your enemies?
Mm-hmm.
How do you build a relationship so that, and how do you build trust so that you can start being changed by them and they can start being changed by you?
Yeah.
I know that's a very personal
Response to it. And yet the issue is, you know, now it's before the Supreme Court and it's a very legal, technical issue that's involving free speech and freedom of expression of religion. And part of me, you know, I really feel that the expression of religion can be very problematic. And it's what Jesus counseled us against, you know. I mean, that all the, you know, Jim Crow laws, for example, all slavery itself was justified biblically. And I think as Christians, we have to own responsibility for that, for our own failure to live into the spirit of the intention of the law, right, that Jesus was pointing us to.
Yeah, there was a senator from, I think it was some, I don't remember, Idaho maybe, Montana maybe, who said, yeah, after this cake ruling, who said, yeah, I think that businesses should be able to not offer services to Black people. That's where this is going. Like, right. That's what this is about.
Right.
You know, it's this us and them, and we're living in 2018 and we're still having these conversations. You know, it's like,
yeah.
What do you do? You know,
well,
Aaron Watson, our friend on Pathos, is like, I'm sorry that we're still doing this, that Christians are still doing this.
Exactly right. No, it's very sad. And I think this question of biblical interpretation, you know, it's a critical one, and it has to be, you know, what's the word? Interrogated in the public sphere, and we have to speak up for the ways in which the biblical text can be manipulated and used to oppress rather than used to heal and transform. And, you know, I think that the reason that Pope Francis is so popular right now is because he's trying to make that shift from sort of legalism of applying doctrine in a legalistic way and saying, yeah, but, you know, these are people that we're dealing with. You know, it's like they're people. And if we're using the law to hurt and oppress, it's just... It's a misuse of the law. And I don't think that, you know, as a Christian, I find it offensive that that Christian faith can be used as a cover for hate speech or hate action or anything. I just find that very offensive. And yep. Makes me angry, like you say.
Yeah. The difficulty is that everybody is framing their position from the point of being a victim.
Yeah.
Right. So mm-hmm. If you take away, if you say, oh, this baker has to make a cake for anybody who comes in, then the Christian right is going to say, oh, now you're taking away our freedom of religion.
Right.
You know, and maybe the whole freedom of religion thing is a misnomer. Yeah. Maybe it's much more the responsibility of religion to work for those who have been marginalized, to work for those who have been excluded, who have been hurt by religion, by a sacrificial form of religion. The Christian religion is to reach out towards the other. So if you've got that understanding of religion, of Christianity, of what Jesus calls us mm-hmm. to, well, of course you're going to bake a cake.
Right. Of course you are. Well, I think that's where, you know, the mimetic theory has really helped me understand that there's more than one type of religion. Like I just never really grasped that until studying mimetic theory and understanding that the Bible itself is wrestling with two different types of religion. One, you know, and this is where our friend James Allison really helps us. One that builds, as you said, by being over and against, by creating victims. And the other, which Jesus was sort of the prime mover or bringing it all to a huge witness that you couldn't ignore anymore, was the way that community is built by recognizing the way in which we are victimizers. We are all victimizers, and we draw our identity from the presence of that victim in our midst who's forgiving us. So as you say, instead of pretending to be a victim, all, you know, instead of using your religion to say, I'm being victimized, that's the old religion. You know, it's actually the old religion corrupting the new one, because that awareness of victims is part of the new way of thinking, the part of the Judeo-Christian perspective. But this sense that rather than I'm a victim, but when we can begin to say I'm a victimizer, ooh, wait, how am I a victimizer right now, puts you in a more humble place, in a more generous place towards other people. And so that's what I think is the radical nature of the biblical witness, which is why it's easily misunderstood or overlooked or whatever, right? Because the ways of Egypt are sort of like the standard way of operating, if you will. You know, mm-hmm. and it corrupts even the revelation that of the futility of its own mechanism.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So how do we get out of it?
Well, I think you're absolutely right about personal connections and witness. I mean, I'm doing a talk back at a local theater in Chicago called Aston Rep on Sunday. And it's they're staging the Laramie Project, which is a play that came out of the terrible scapegoating murder of a gay man in Laramie, Wyoming, of Matthew Shepard. This was 20 years ago. So it's the anniversary of it. But I'm mentioning it because the way the play was constructed is a witness to how to get out of it, because it was a New York City theater company founded by two gay men who heard of this terrible murder in Wyoming. It was gruesome and everything. And instead of saying, oh, those damn homophobic cowboys out in Laramie, Wyoming, they said, maybe we should go out there. Maybe we should go to Laramie and talk to the people and actually listen. And they did. And they went, like, they did like 200 interviews or something over a year and a half, something wild. And the play that emerged out of it is this very complex play that shows all the different dimensions of how we scapegoat one another. not just how, you know, urban scapegoats rural and rural cowboys scapegoat the educated theater elite in New York. You know, it's all these us versus them categories show up in this play. And there's over 70 characters get represented in the play. 70 people are heard from. With 12 characters, 12 actors do 70 people. So it's just an incredible witness to the, you know, the way in which we all inhabit different roles at different times, you know, and scapegoat in different ways. But the bottom line was that the people of Laramie were so grateful that someone was listening to them instead of just assuming that they were all rubes and rednecks and jerks. And they were listened to, and the play was performed in Laramie, and they were like, you told the truth. You told us in all our complexity. You put all our laundry out there, but you did it honestly. And it was, it, I think the play is a witness to that kind of daring to listen to the one who you can quickly dismiss, easily dismiss, you know.
Yeah, that's the problem with the frame of being hostile towards religion.
Right? Yeah.
Is that you just, Gerard helps us understand that hostility, that violence is mimetic. So if you go after someone with hostility and you're expecting them to say, oh, yes, of course, you're right. that's not going to work.
No.
Right? So, but if you go in and you listen and you take the long journey of transformation together, I think there's more hope in that.
Yeah. Which is why that this is a legal problem is almost futility. It can't be solved legally, right? I mean, the Supreme Court and the states and everything, and we're trying to solve it legally, and I think it's very important for us as a people, as the American people, to get our laws right in terms of what sort of behavior will we tolerate in the public sphere. But so you put the law in the books, but then how you change people's hearts and minds is a different, you know.
Just as important is to reach out to those who need us with.
Well, it's, I mean, again, the parallels to civil rights for African Americans, the laws are on the book, but have hearts and minds been changed? You know, even behavior goes underground and manifests in different ways. You can outlaw discrimination in one area and it pops up somewhere else because the law, you know, the law can be subverted too easily. So I think you have to have parallel tracks, which is what those of us who, you know, like yourself, a public theologian or someone who dares to say, I'm a Christian in the public sphere, we need to be on that parallel track along with the law, representing the best of what we want to be is the way you end your sermon, which is, you know, about the ideals of our nation, which is to welcome the oppressed, welcome the immigrant at our border. We haven't talked that much about that, but I hope the connection is obvious that, you know, our ideals as a nation are to live into this witness to community and welcoming community, right?
It's the great thing about the Sabbath law in Deuteronomy, the fourth commandment. It says, everybody gets a day of rest. Remember, you were once slaves in Egypt. Mm-hmm. And that's a call to empathy. You know, remember, you were in this position once. And you take it further. You were in this position once. You left Egypt to find refuge somewhere else. So not only were you slaves in Egypt, you were also immigrants. You were also refugees.
Yeah.
So have some empathy for the immigrant in your midst. Have some empathy for the refugee. And you and I and the vast majority of people at our churches and probably friends on Facebook were in one way or another immigrants. Like, you know, my ancestors immigrated from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bible is saying, remember that you were once immigrants, you were once in Egypt and you left, you or your ancestors. Mm-hmm. So treat the immigrant with compassion. That's the best that the Bible has to offer. It's the best of the United. It's what I. It's one of the many things that I love about the United States. You know, oftentimes liberals like myself get pinpointed as pigeonholed as, oh, you're just anti-American. No, I love America. I love my country. Absolutely. I love the ideals that we have, and I want us to live into those ideals. And come to the United States because this is where you will have the best life. You know, that's what we tell people. And then we say, nope, we give them a double bind. Come here. No, you can't.
Oh, just
come here.
Kidding. No,
we're going to put you in jail and we're going to separate you from your children. Right. Really? Is that us at our best? No. No. Sorry.
No.
We're so much better than that. And I'm so much hopeful that things will change. We will change those laws. We'll see this as a bad point in American history, and we will change. That's what we're going to do.
That's what we do.
Yeah. Awesome. So do you have any other final thoughts on this, Suzanne?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I wish I had a piece of cake to eat with you right now at the end here.
Yes.
I think these are things that we need to keep wrestling with and not being afraid to talk about with each other.
Amen to that. Mm-hmm. Awesome. So thank you, everybody, for watching this episode of The Ravencast. You can find more episodes of The Ravencast at The Raven Review at ravenfoundation.org. So until next time, grace and peace be with you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.